The president's deficit panel proposes cuts.
And they're still waiting for the applause.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Veterans Day, Thursday, November 11th. Coming up, foreclosures were down in October, but that might not be as good as it sounds. Plus, want to buy Bernie Madoff's carbon monoxide detector?
But first, the plan from the leaders of the president's deficit panel has been out for less than 24 hours, and there's already red-hot reaction. The proposal calls for cuts in military spending, Medicare spending, a gradual increase in the retirement age for Social Security benefits. Oh yeah, and also ending tax breaks on things like mortgage interest and healthcare plans. But it would cut deficits by as much as $4 trillion over the next decade. Now for some reaction to the panel's proposals, let's turn to Diane Lim Rogers, who's chief economist at the Concord Coalition, a nonpartisan group that focuses on deficit reduction. She joins us from Washington. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So, Diane, I just outlined some of the big ticket items. Do you think that if this plan went through as it is, that it would do what needs to be done?
I do. The math certainly works out. It's real math. It's a brutally honest plan that spares no sacred cows and avoids no third rails. It's a nice mix of both spending cuts and revenue increases that manages to get deficits down to what's considered economically sustainable.
All right. You call it a nice mix. We got reaction today from President Obama over at the G20 meeting in South Korea. Here's what he had to say.
We're going to have to take actions that are difficult, and we're going to have to tell the truth to the American people.
So difficult actions, Diane. But do you think that these proposals are politically possible when it comes to not just Congress, but the full deficit commission? This was just the leaders that we heard from so far.
Well, we'll have to see. Initial reaction is certainly in the attack and cower mode. You know, both sides of the debate are pretty entrenched in their positions. Democrats don't like to see any cuts to Social Security benefits. Republicans are pretty insistent that revenues, taxes as a share of the economy can't come up or won't come up. Commission chairmen have done a tremendous service to the American people in saying, look, these are the tough choices that we have to make in order to actually solve the problems. And I think that politicians won't be able to get away with just saying no or saying it can't be done anymore.
All right, we shall see. Diane Lim Rogers, chief economist at the Concord Coalition, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks.
For one more take on this, let's bring in Diane Swank, chief economist at Mesro Financial. She's with us from Chicago. Good morning. So let's just pretend for a minute that this plan gets enacted as is. Would it do the trick?
It's a start, but it's not going to fully cure the problems that ail us, but it is a step in the right direction.
Okay, and let's live in the world of reality. The Democrats have already come out and said they're unhappy with cuts to entitlements. Republicans are saying they don't want to raise taxes on anything. Any chance this plan actually gets through the sausage-making machine in Washington?
I think the chances are next to nil. We've got an incoming Congress committed to conflict rather than compromise. And at the end of the day, although this plan, it looks at both sides of the ledger, which any economist will tell you is the only way to fundamentally reduce our deficit, there's just too many sacred cows for us to tackle at this stage of the game. And special interest groups behind all those people now already criticizing it are lining up.
Okay, Diane Swank, chief economist at Mesro Financial, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The number of homeowners who got a foreclosure notice in October dropped by 4%. The number of homes foreclosed on dropped by 9%. That's according to foreclosure listing firm Realty Track. Seems like good news, right? Well, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports there are still plenty of people in danger of losing their homes. It's just that paperwork issues are slowing things down.
Realty Track attributes the decline in foreclosures to the robo-signing controversy, where banks were caught seizing properties without going through the proper legal hoops. Investigations have slowed foreclosures down, but they should rebound, says Desmond Lockman at the American Enterprise Institute.
This whole issue with robo-signing, all that is going to do, if stretch out the length of time that it'll take the property market to find a bottom.
Lockman says the underlying problems causing people to stop paying their mortgages aren't getting better either. Those would be unemployment and homeowners who owe more than their house is worth. And with foreclosed properties flooding the market, Lockman says home prices will keep falling.
A weakness in the housing market just heightens the risk that the United States could experience a double-dip recession.
Right now, foreclosure rates are worst in Nevada, Florida, Arizona, California, and Michigan. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, November 11th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org.
We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States.
Leaders of 20 of the world's biggest economies are meeting in South Korea today. Over the next few days, we're going to hear a lot about how the G20 will tackle currency manipulation and trade wars, among other things. But we thought we'd give you a little primer of what the G20 is and how it'll affect the global economy. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is here from London to break it down for us. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So, all right, the 20 biggest economies, that sounds like a big deal, is it?
Yes, certainly. I mean, these are the leaders of the 19 richest economies, including the US and China, plus the European Union as a group. Between them, they represent 85% of the global economy, so pretty significant.
All right, so a powerful bunch, but how effective is it in working together?
Well, the G20 became the world's main economic forum in 2008 as the global economic crisis began to unfold, and the body did prove effective then by these countries getting together and agreeing to coordinate policies and stimulate their economies. Here's Sean Rickard, senior economist at the Cranfield School of Management.
I think they probably prevented a 1930s-type slump sweeping across the world. So one has to say it does have its uses. It has been very successful.
But Stephen, the global economy hasn't fully recovered. I mean, can this group score another success at this meeting?
Oh, it seems much less likely. We're out of the immediate crisis. The panic subsided. Minds are not quite so concentrated. And there are big divisions. I mean, some countries feel they should cut their debt. Others, like the US, want to continue with the stimulus. And we've got that bitter row over currency manipulation between China and the US. It was all a lot easier when the old G7 was the main economic forum, when the US ruled the roost with its European allies. But those days are long gone. Now we've got to cooperate with many more players.
Certainly remember those G7 days. All right, Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Let's focus a little more on the currency fight between the United States and China. The BBC's Andrew Walker is with us now from the summit in Seoul. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Steve.
We've heard about these tensions between the U.S. and China and others. What's the atmosphere like? Can you feel the tension?
Well, if you wander around the conference center, the very modern, rather anonymous conference center, it's not very obvious. But frankly, listening to the things that some of the leaders and especially some of their finance ministers have said before the summit, it's clear there is going to be real tension at some stages around that conference table.
You've covered these summits before. How do you know if it's a success?
Well, if you take the view that they need to make progress on the big issue that's been catching the headlines, currency wars, as some people have called it, I think you'd take the view almost certainly that it's not been a success because it's going to be so hard to get any progress. But there are some people who think that's just the wrong issue to focus on. For example, the Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, Angel Gurría, he told me the currency row shouldn't be allowed to overshadow what he considers the two most important issues facing world economies.
Growth and jobs, you know, this is what discussion should be about. The convergence should be about growth and jobs. The framework should be about growth and jobs. After all, currencies are just an instrument.
Well, maybe he's right, but at this summit, it sounds like currencies are an instrument playing out of tune.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in Seoul. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve.
And as those G20 leaders meet in South Korea, U.S. and South Korean officials are talking amongst themselves. They're trying to hammer out a new trade pact covering beef, cars, and other products. There's no deal yet, but President Obama says he wants one signed in weeks, not months. Of course, getting support in Congress won't be easy, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
Capitol Hill never approved a trade deal the two countries struck in 2007. Jeff Schott is an economist at the Peterson Institute.
There were concerns in the United States about the auto provisions.
Ford and Chrysler weren't happy with the terms of car imports and exports. American beef producers didn't like the restrictions on their meat. Schott says now President Obama is trying again.
They're not redoing the document. What they are doing is augmenting it.
The idea is to open South Korea to U.S. banks, cell phone makers, and others. But supporters of the deal face homegrown obstacles. A new report shows a majority of Americans don't like free trade agreements, including many members of the GOP. Carol Doherty is with the Pew Research Center.
Republicans are where the action is, and it's somewhat surprising in historical terms.
Members aligned with the Tea Party are opposed to it. So are some union-backed Democrats. So the White House may face an even tougher negotiation with an unlikely coalition. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lists diabetes as the seventh leading cause of death in the United States. High obesity rates, a big contributor there. But India isn't as developed as the United States, and yet a big rise in diabetes cases in that country is startling doctors and the government. Jason Gale is a health and science reporter for Bloomberg and writes about an Indian diabetes epidemic in this month's Bloomberg Markets magazine. Jason, welcome to Marketplace.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Doing well. What set you off on this path?
A couple of years ago, I was on a field trip in the Indian city of Bangalore that looked at a diabetes project there. A group of healthcare workers test people's feet. And as I watched the podiatrists and the healthcare workers, I was really struck by the people in whom they were diagnosing type 2 diabetes. We associate type 2 diabetes with a lifetime of overeating and inactivity. In rural India, and healthcare workers are finding it in men and women in their 30s and 40s who are physically active and who are not especially fat. It just seemed totally bizarre to me.
What is it, Jason, about the rising middle class in India? Why is there such a jump in cases of diabetes with those folks?
Well, I think it's a combination of many things, like changes in diet. People were eating a lot more refined rice than they were 20 years ago. But there's a legacy of poverty, which has really set Indians up for developing obesity and the diseases with it much earlier than people who haven't experienced malnutrition, particularly in the womb and right from the start.
I didn't realize, Jason, only 5% of the Indian population has health insurance. What kind of economic impact is that having?
A study in 2007 found that diabetes costs the Indian GDP at 2.1% every year. So that's a huge cost, and it's mostly in lost earnings and productivity.
That's amazingly large, right?
It is. And the World Bank came out with a study in January that found that if India could eliminate all its non-communicable diseases like diabetes and heart disease, the $1.3 trillion economy would be 4 to 10% greater in size. So that's a substantial amount of money that would be gained by eliminating these diseases.
Jason Gale is a health and science reporter for Bloomberg with us from Singapore. Jason, thank you.
No worries, Steve. Cheers.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, November 11th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org. Believe it or not, we are just 2 weeks away from Black Friday and its modern-day corollary, Cyber Monday. Walmart isn't waiting, though. Starting today, Walmart will offer free shipping through its online store. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out if this is the beginning of a free shipping war.
Buy a TV, a laptop, or tens of thousands of other presents from Walmart.com, and the shipping is free. Russell Jones is a retail analyst at Alex Partners. He says it's a perk that's popping up all over the place.
A lot of the major e-tailers are offering free shipping already. Many, including, for example, L.L. Bean, already offering free shipping on everything in the store. from now through December 20th.
Jones says offering free shipping is a way for stores to compete with Amazon, which isn't offering free shipping on most orders. It doesn't have to, because as the king of online shopping, it makes the rules. Jones says free shipping may hurt everybody else's margins, but it's better than losing business. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Start spreading the news.
This is a Manhattan-bound train.
Well, you may have noticed that this podcast has become bi-coastal this week. It'll be that way for the next few months with Steve in L.A. and me here in New York. And we're starting things off this week by getting to know some of the people who make the economy here in the Big Apple what it is. Today, we've got the head of the only airline based in New York City, JetBlue. And we welcome CEO Dave Barger to Marketplace. Dave Barger, great to have you here.
Hey, great to be with you, Jeremy. Thanks.
How has JetBlue experienced the recession so far? And are you feeling a recovery at this point?
Well, we have. And in fact, really a recessionary environment for us is actually less headwind or turbulence, I think, than what we'd see in a strong economy. And last year, in the middle of, I think, what's now known as the Great Recession, we were profitable in all four quarters.
Your father was an airline pilot for United, I read.
That's correct. 37 years at Pennsylvania Central, Capital Airlines, and then United Airlines. So airlines in the family, Jeremy.
Did you fly with him as a kid?
I did. I was on the retirement flight from Seattle to Chicago O'Hare. I'll never forget it because there were several of us in the cockpit. It wasn't a very good landing either, and we had a lot of fun with that. Dad's last flight, but the landing was a little bit rocky, but I say that as I'm a little bit in jest and laughing. He had a great career kind of at the right time. He was always a captain as he was flying over the course of those almost four decades.
Okay, let's do a lightning round here. Quick questions, quick answers. What is your favorite destination that JetBlue flies to?
Burlington, Vermont.
Why do you say that?
You feel you're really back to nature in a major way. It's great quality of life in Burlington, Vermont.
JetBlue is famous for having TVs in every seat. Which channel do you find yourself watching most often on a flight?
There's no doubt about it, the moving map.
Is JetBlue ever going to fly to Europe and Asia?
I've learned to never say never.
Have you ever grabbed a beer from the galley and slid down the emergency slide?
The only toast I've ever taken aboard our aircraft has been on the delivery of new airplanes, either out of Toulouse, France with Airbus, or out of San Jose down in Brazil with a bottle of champagne, congratulating those who made the delivery possible. So that's the only thing I've ever had aboard our airplanes. I haven't grabbed a beer from the galley.
Very diplomatic answer. Dave Barger, CEO of JetBlue, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
And finally, Steve, I don't know if you've been following the stories about Bernie Madoff's property being auctioned off.
Oh, the slippers, everything else I know.
The slippers, the jewelry, the mansions, all that stuff. But now it is getting really weird. This Saturday, you will be able to buy his carbon monoxide detector.
Oh, nice.
That's, I know. And this one, you'll love his Neutrogena shampoo bottle.
Very good shampoo, yeah.
And, of course, his board games. I didn't know Bernie Madoff played board games, but I'm getting an image in my head of a guy playing a version of Jenga with
Jenga,
an infinite number of blocks.
Oh, so many blocks.
Just can't fall down. It's the unlosable Jenga, but I don't know. That's just me. Anyway, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.